Thank you for the kind presentation and for the kind invitation to participate in this conference to all the organizers. I'm really enjoying the conference so far. Well, colonialism is the most important, or at least one of the most important, political discourses that shaped the world order in the 19th and 20th centuries. Due to the independence of most of the Latin American countries in the early 19th century, Latin America generally is perceived as a part and more as a forerunner in the post-colonial world. So colonialism, it seems, is none of Latin America's business in the period under consideration in my presentation. Still, in the next 25 minutes or so, I will show that South America belonged to the colonial world in the imaginaries of the people in Germany, and for sure in many other parts in Europe and in North America. My paper will deal with the cultural history of the imaginaries and of the representations of the way South American space was appropriated in German colonial contexts in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But of course, my paper is somewhat transverse to the general outline of the conference, that, at least as I understood it, rather points to the role in actual, it is politically established colonial and imperial settings. However, my paper deals with an important yet often neglected aspect of Latin America and the colonial world order. And seen from the other, the European side, it deals with an important yet also often neglected aspect of the cultural history of European colonialism. My paper will have a special focus on visual media. This is owed to the fact that it draws on my latest research project that deals with photographs and postcards from South America and the idea people in Germany had of the foreign continent in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But actually, visual media and visual strategies played an important role in the process of appropriating space in colonial and imperial context almost everywhere, not only in the case of the German colonial fantasies pertaining to South America, that I will deal with in the following. After some introductory remarks on Germany's colonial and post-colonial relations to Latin America, and some theoretical and methodological considerations on the role of visual media and visuality, I will deal with German immigration to South America. So I can relate to your presentation, with Bertha and all the German immigrants to Kansas. I will then turn to colonial ideas and fantasies pertaining to South America and to the colonial imaginary. Finally, I will try to determine South America's role in German colonial discourse. So, is an investigation of German colonial discourse pertaining to South America a paradoxical enterprise? For on the one hand, most of the South American territory consisted of independent states, with the exception of Dutch, English, and French Guiana, since the 1810s and 1820s. And on the other hand, Germany had never really been a player on the American subcontinent, with the exception of three minor experiments during the 16th and 17th centuries, the briefly held so-called Welser colony on the territory of modern-day Venezuela, the failed Hanau plan to colonize some 100,000 square kilometers on the Caribbean coast granted in fief by the Dutch West India Company, and the Prussian lease of part of the Caribbean islands St. Thomas and Crab Island from Denmark. But despite the small scale and brevity of the German presence on the American subcontinent, South America had fueled German colonial imaginary since the days of the conquistadores, and to an even greater extent since Alexander von Humboldt's famous travels in this part of the world. For the latter part of the 19th century and into the 20th, however, Latin America did not play an important role in the mind of the German public. In his book, Südamerika wird fotografiert, South America is being photographed, published in 1932, author and travel writer Kasimir Edschmidt noted, South America is even less well known among educated Europeans than Africa and Asia. Indeed, with only few exceptions, as for instance during the War of the Triple Alliance in the 1860s, or the Venezuelan crisis in 1902-1903, and first and foremost, the issue of German immigration, the American subcontinent rarely featured in the German press. Still, throughout the 19th century, a number of scientists, writers, businessmen, and investors, as well as hundreds of thousands of German immigrants, did show an interest in South America. Among the authors of literary works playing in South America are the mentioned Casimir Edschmidt, as well as Friedrich Gerstecker, Sophie Wörishofer, Ferdinand Emmerich, Ernst Friedrich Löhndorff, and the most popular Karl May. And while there seemed to have been little concrete knowledge on South America circulating in the German public sphere, the German imagination of the subcontinent appears to have been a lively one. You may not know the authors and their works listed here, but in Germany they were bestseller authors in their times, and some still are. Photographic media played a decisive role in fueling the South American colonial fantasy. Since the 19th century, richly illustrated travel literature, guides for emigrants, handbooks, and other scientific and fictional publications provided detailed information on the various countries' histories, economies, societies, and climates. Postcards sent from South America by emigrants and travelers to relatives and friends back home in Germany served to further inspire the image of the foreign continent. Visual as well as textual media helped to foster stereotypes and to project fantasies onto South America, just as they had done since the first contacts between Europeans and indigenous Americans in the course of the European expansion. European knowledge on South America has always been transmitted visually, as evidenced, for instance, by the illustrations that accompanied Hans Staden's famous travel account of Brazil, first published in 1557. In contrast to the immigration trends in other European countries, the number of German emigrants to South America was rather small. The majority of German migrants to South America settled in Brazil, and most German settlements were located in the south of Brazil, as you can see on the map here, because the milder climate in southern Brazil compared to the hot and tropical climate in north Brazil. Some 280,000 German native speakers came to Brazil between 1886 and 1936. This was still a relatively insignificant figure compared with the 5 million Germans who had emigrated to the northern part of the Americas by 1900. On the other hand, until 1914, only about 12,000 Germans had migrated to Germany's most significant settler colony in Africa's southwest. The resulting importance of South America and its Auslandsdeutschtum, which one may translate as Germanness abroad or Germans abroad, for German colonial discourse was emphasized by many contemporary authors. The study on Blumenau, a German colony in southern Brazil, by the Altdeutsche Karl Alexander Wettstein, with his motto, you can find it under the picture, "Germanness abroad is our most important colony," is only one example. Since the 19th century, German emigrants to the Americas, to the German colonies, and indeed to Eastern Europe, where Germans had settled since the Middle Ages, were regarded as Auslandsdeutsche, as Germans abroad. Researchers and historians have highlighted the importance of the increasingly völkisch interpretation of Germanness as part of the imagined community, as defined by Benedict Anderson. German nationality, as decreed in 1913, was acquired by virtue of ancestry, not by virtue of residence within the boundaries of the German Reich. While the legislative amendment was made primarily in an effort to address the uncertain status of settlers and their children in the colonies, in the eyes of the law and in public perception, it applied to all citizens. The Auslandsdeutsche, Germans abroad, therefore remained Germans regardless of the degree of their assimilation into their new home or, conversely, their adherence to German customs and the use of German language. Of the literature dealing with immigration to the American subcontinent, several studies have examined the German case, seldom, however, under the auspices of colonial studies, even though the sources on German immigration to South America speak of colonialists or colonists, colonization and colonies well into the 1950s. In contrast to this, German immigrants to the United States or to Canada were no longer addressed as colonists after 1920. In 1930, Emil Dronberg, the German Jack he's labeled the German Jack London, for instance, refers to immigrants in Canada as ansiedler, as settlers, not as colonists. The avoidance of colonial language was probably due to the contemporary image of the United States and Canada as modern, civilized, Western republican nations that differed greatly from the prevailing image of the wild, politically unstable, economically and infrastructurally underdeveloped subcontinent of South America. In this light, it is not surprising that contemporaries used the terminology of colonialism. Although mostly consisting of independent states, South America seemed not that different from other global peripheries. Admittedly, the German term colonization, probably referred primarily to the cultivation of land, thus following common usage in most South American countries too. Nevertheless, South America was viewed by Germans from a colonialist perspective, although it was for the most part free from European colonialism. German historian Wolfgang Reinhardt, I don't know how well known he is in France. In Germany, he's a big name with works on the European expansion. He seems to be right in stating that historically colonization without colonialism has rarely been possible. There were several motivations for emigrating from Germany to the South American subcontinent, to North America, or for settling in the colonies. Foremost was a strong economic motivation. Immigrants hoped to improve their lot by becoming landowners and or by establishing new business. From the second half of the 19th century until well into the 1920s, a large number of books on the informal colonization of South America, that is, on the establishment of commercial, industrial, or agricultural enterprises and the investment of capital, were published in Germany. Guidebooks provided information on climate, weights and measures, addresses of consular offices, investment opportunities, and much more besides. These guidebooks for Auswanderungslustige inclined emigrants, to quote the title of a 1919 work by Emil Runge, were complemented by travel literature, accounts of authentic as well as fictitious emigrants' fates, and expeditions as described in the popular works of Karl May, contemporary taken to be true. The boundary between fiction and non-fiction was just as fluid as it had been since the earliest days of European expansion. This kind of propaganda was neither new nor unique, of course. Since the 19th century, immigration agencies had used similar advertising methods in magazines and newspapers to entice Germans to the United States. As regards South America, the publications focused mainly on Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Peru. Interestingly, Chile, another major destination for German immigrants, was not covered that much. Many of the books were richly illustrated with photographs. They attempted to entice Germans by visually emphasizing that these countries were economically and infrastructurally appealing. The immigrants would be in a position to exploit natural resources, engage in agricultural industry, and conduct trade without distractions. Photographs of railways, paradigmatic symbols of progress through the Andes, show that even the most inhospitable terrain was developed. While pictures of pleasant rural estates alongside the continent's modern metropolises, equipped with romantic parks, sports and leisure facilities, showed the potential for a comfortable life on the American subcontinent. Colonialists did not even have to do without German schools. Images of Buenos Aires in particular suggest that this city compared well with European metropolises and that the German immigrant did not have to make do without the amenities of big city life. This image of Buenos Aires as an electrified metropolis, for example, represents the popular motif of urban modernity on postcards. The use of postcards exploded during the first decades of the 20th century in Europe and in the Americas, and they were an important medium in terms of communicating the message of a progressive South America. They carry classic images associated with modernity, such as trains, railways, government palaces, national banks, hotels, ports, factories, production sites, botanical gardens, and the zoo in Buenos Aires. These images reminded Germans at home that South America's biggest cities were not all that different from European metropolises. As Karl May wrote about the Uruguayan capital Montevideo, one might as well be in Bordeaux or Trieste. By the way, South American governments actively participated in this process. They issued not only textual but also visual media to attract European immigrants, as demonstrate these postcards published by the Mission Brésilienne de Propagande in Paris in the early 20th centuries. Negative aspects associated with the American subcontinent, such as widespread political instability, thematized in the works of Gerstlecker, May, Edgemead, or others, for instance, the tropical climate, which had been an important factor in the German colonies in Africa, or the degeneration and Verkafferung, acculturation of Germans as a result of socializing and mixing with allegedly racially inferior indigenous and mestizos, another important factor in German colonial policy in Africa, generally were sidelined in the guidebooks and in visual media. An exception to this is this picture postcard from the collection of the Altonaer Museum in Hamburg, which is one of my all-time favorites. The postcard published by Jorge Ellert, a German immigrant, owner of the Libreria Comercial in Porto Alegre, was sent to Almar Tangermann in Altona near Hamburg in October 1913. The sender thanked Almar for the beautiful photocard she sent him from a cafe in Altona. He then continues, "Such thing does not exist here. Here everything is a sh." So, that everything was a shit in Porto Alegre could be seen on the picture postcard. Nobody would have doubted that you could not find a beautiful cafe here. Another rare document is this picture postcard of Conventillo in Buenos Aires. It shows the dark side of the modern metropolis immigrants are confronted with: the social question, confined living conditions, and poverty. But indeed, most authors of travelogues and adventure stories emphasized that a fresh start in making a living in South America would not be easy. One would need a strong will to break down the barriers, and it would be hard work to forge a new life. But corresponding with the idea that the civilizing mission of colonialism was the white man's burden, these concerns were even welcomed. The discomfort with the perceived decadence of German culture and its softening effects on the individual, in particular on the German man, resulted in the projection of hopes and desires onto the American subcontinent. During the time of the German Empire and in Weimar Germany, especially Völkisch groups exalted Germans abroad in South America. Literary works and visual media emphasized the bravery, industriousness, and purity of the German settlers. They were endorsed. As the embodiment of what it meant to be German and as role models for future immigrants. This idea of the German colonist is particularly strong in the works of Franz Donat, a German immigrant to Brazil, as shows this quote from his Paradise and Hell, published in 1926. "Yes, dear fatherland, you may be reassured. Reassured and proud, the children you let go will not get lost. They built a German Heimat abroad, not with a sword, but with strength and industry. They wrested a land from the wilderness, German to the core." End of quote. This rhetoric corresponds exactly with the German colonial mission, as stated, for instance, by Richard Wagner in his famous 1848 pro-colonialism article. Yes, this is Richard Wagner, the composer. Quote, We will sail in ships across the sea and here and there set up a new Germany, inseminated with the results of our struggle and our aspirations, beget and educate the noblest and godlike children. We will do better than the Spanish, for whom the New World became a cleric-ridden slaughterhouse, and differently from the English, for whom it became a treasure trove. We will do it in a wonderful, a German way. End of quote. Another element of the South American fantasy concerned the search for alternative ways of living. Disillusioned with the Western lifestyle, its boundaries, safety, norms, and values, Europeans sought mental and physical escape in favor of freedom, adventure, and personal fulfillment. In the tradition of Germans that emigrated to the Americas for religious reasons in the 19th and 20th centuries, and in the context of the Lebensreform movement, I don't know how to translate Lebensreform, it's a German alternative lifestyle project by, from the turn of the century. In the context of this movement, vegetarian colonies were established in Brazil, and personalities such as young Hermann Hesse even entertained the idea of affiliating himself with one of them. Hermann Hesse then decided to go to Monte Verita. But this kind of escapism drew on an established tradition of colonial fantasies dating from the first reports on the New World that reached Europe in the 16th century. South America was ascribed the status of unlimited possibilities in this respect. The notion of personal freedom associated with the South American fantasy comprised the sexual dimension too. Orientalist research, inspired by the work of Edward Said, has shown that fantasiacal Europeans imagined a sexually charged, mysterious Orient, a hidden harem world full of seductive danseuses, as the other of restrictive European morals. The spatial distance and the supposed cultural and racial difference allowed the projection of these sexual desires and fantasies onto the Orient, and indeed also onto South America. The subcontinent was imagined as a space of unlimited sexual opportunities. This image had a long and familiar history. Since the times of the Conquista, which saw the mass rape of the female indigenous population, the female-connoted American subcontinent was depicted as awaiting penetration by male-connoted Europe. During the 19th and 20th centuries, the racialist thought constructed indigenous people as natural beings with an excessive libido and sexual liberalism, but with no control over their urges. This image was spread and popularized in visual media as well. Many anthropologists and ethnologists transmitted and circulated pictures of nude and half-nude indigenous men and mostly women. Due to the time, cut here, but I think the patterns underlying the sexualized European, in my case German, conception of indigenous men and women in South America is the same, or at least similar to the sexualized colonial gaze, to borrow from Marie Pratt, on the colonized people in Africa, for instance. Images of indigenous as natural beings corresponded with images of natural landscapes. So alongside the visual emphasis on modernity in postcards and guidebooks, images of untamed landscapes and unspoiled nature, mostly stemming from the Andes, Patagonia, or the Amazonian jungle, challenged the pioneering spirit of adventurous Europeans wishing to escape the confines of normality back home. The conflation and universalization of national and individual hopes and their projection onto the foreign continent is evident in the title of Otto Nordenskiöld's handbook Südamerika, ein Zukunftsland der Menschheit, South America, a Future Land for Humanity, which I therefore borrowed from my title as well. The aim of the handbook was to provide information for academics, potential immigrants, and dreamers on humanity's future place, and the biblical connotation of the promised land is unmistakable. Coming to a close, I will bother or delight, I don't know, you with some more theoretical issues and analytical results. Susanne Zantop's well-known concept of pre-colonial colonial fantasies centers on the notion that colonial imagination could very well function in the absence of actual colonies. an analysis of imperial and Weimar Germany's colonial imaginary of South America demonstrates that the colonial experience of the pre-war period sustained and amplified colonial fantasies into the post-colonial era. Republican Germany was, to quote Marsha Klotz, a post-colonial state in a still colonial world. Still, as many studies have shown, colonial discourse flourished in the years after the loss of the overseas territories, and colonialism continued to be deeply rooted in German society. In the post-war period, writes Robbie Aitken, Germans continued to conceptualize their world in terms of colonialist categories, in spite of the fact that Germany was no longer a colonial power. In this regard, David Thomas Murphy identifies the disparity between the actual significance the overseas empire had held for German society, which was very small, and the enormous amount of language, paper and ink, and futile energy expended on its recovery after the Versailles peace settlement. In contrast to the post-1919 colonial imagination pertaining to German colonies in Africa and the South Pacific, the fantasy relating to South America lacked the character of rupture, since there were and never had been any colonies to lose. Thus, the memory of engagement with South America could have provided Weimar Germany with a blueprint for engaging with colonial space in general and former colonial possessions in particular. I emphasize the role of visual media for the colonial imagination of South America. Following Mary Louise Pratt's idea of a colonial gaze that determines and regulates the relations of the European selves and the others in situations of cultural contact and cultural transfers, I examined images stemming from and being part of a social space that, again following Pratt, can be called contact zone, a space to be appropriated and waiting, yes, longing even, for European, in my case German, colonization. And third, the German colonial perception of the South American global periphery seen with imperial eyes is not so different from other peripheries in Africa, the Orient, or the South Seas. Images of primitive and barbarian indigenous people, for instance, resemble each other whether they are from Papua, from German East or Southwest Africa, or from the Amazonian jungle, the Chaco, or Patagonia. The same goes for visualizations of colonial spaces and landscapes. Jens Jäger, well-known historian of visual history in Germany, for instance, has shown how images from German colonies in Africa serve to incorporate the foreign land into the Heimat when the Kilimanjaro was Germany's highest peak. Similarly, German settlements in Brazil or Chile showed Heimat abroad. Having said all this, of course, there is a huge difference between Latin America and other colonial spaces. First, in Latin America, unlike in other regions, there were political and intellectual elites that intervened, participated, and shaped political and national discourses. And second, global modern metropolises like Buenos Aires were not exactly numerous in Africa. This distinguishes Latin America from other colonial peripheries in the world. And this difference is a continuity from the 19th through the 20th century and to this day. To borrow from Stuart Hall, Latin America is neither the West nor the rest. Thank you for your attention.